This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. It's June 21st, 1948 in Ellisville, Mississippi. And Davis Knight is in love. He met Junie Lee Spradley a few years ago. They got married and settled down on a farm in Mississippi. But on this day, that love is being put to the test. Davis Knight is in court. A grand jury is indicting him for violating the state's law against miscegenation. That's an antiquated word for an interracial relationship. There's no recordings of that case, but we had an actor read the indictment.
Davis Knight, on the 21st day of June, 1948, in the county and district aforesaid, did, being a citizen of the state of Mississippi and a Negro or a mulatto male person with 1/8 or more of Negro blood.
Davis appears to be white, but he's facing charges because his great-grandmother was black. In 1940s Mississippi, that heritage was enough to indict him.
And being a person who is prohibited by the laws of the state of Mississippi from marrying a white person or a person of the Caucasian race, did on or about the 18th day of April, 1946, willfully and feloniously and unlawfully marry Junie Lee Spradley, a white female person, and did willfully, feloniously, and unlawfully live with her and cohabit with her as man and wife, against the peace and dignity of the state of Mississippi.
Davis was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in Parchment Prison. The state Supreme Court eventually overturned the conviction. But Davis and Junie's marriage was short-lived. The couple separated a few years later. In 1967, nearly 20 years after Davis Knight was convicted, the U.S. Supreme Court finally overturned anti-miscegenation laws with the Loving v. Virginia case. But in Mississippi, interracial marriages were still in a gray area because they were outlawed as a part of the state's constitution. I should be clear, Mississippi is not an outlier. Most states had these same laws at some point in their history. But it wasn't until 1987 that Mississippi voters passed an amendment to its constitution guaranteeing the right to marriages that cross racial lines. The vote was extremely close, 52% in favor, 48% against. At the time, a political science professor at a mostly white private college in Mississippi told the Associated Press that some people just couldn't bring themselves to do it. People still have deep-seated feelings about interracial marriages. He said, the old phrase probably kept coming up. Would you want your daughter to marry one? As recently as 2011, there was still strong opposition to interracial marriages in Mississippi. A poll found that 46% of Republicans were against it. The fear of black men and white women being intimate, having children, and cohabitating was the fuel that white supremacy used to murder black men. Many of their names fill the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. Allegations of rape or even just a rumor of a black man flirting with a white woman could end in death. And that's the fertile ground where fears and suspicion took root for Billy Joe Johnson's family. You're listening to Reveal's Serial Investigation.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn!
Mississippi Goddamn, the ballad of Billy Joe. This is episode 5, Starcrossed. The Department of Justice stresses the importance of getting a full picture of a victim's life by talking to friends, family, and acquaintances. But when the DOJ reviewed Billie Joe's case, they didn't do that. They did a mostly paper review, meaning they based their report largely on what they found in the case file created by the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation and the local district attorney's office. After we interviewed Special Agent Joe Wallace, we realized investigators focused on interviewing people who reportedly crossed paths with Billie Joe the morning of his death. Joe Sullivan, the deputy who pulled him over, other members of law enforcement, and Billie Joe's ex-girlfriend, Hannah Hollinghead, who said Billie Joe had made an unexpected stop at her trailer the morning he died. But that gives a limited view of who Billie Joe was and what was going on in his life around the time of his death. So now, we're going to take a closer look. On the day Billie Joe died, he had a lot to look forward to. He was planning to go to a student award banquet later that day. He had football scholarship offers from schools like Auburn and Alabama. He had a busy social life. Inside his truck were notes from several girls. Friends say he dated a lot. On one of our trips to Mississippi, we stopped by the Johnson's place to check in.
He is not in the mood to be friendly. Mr. Johnson, how you doing today?
I'm doing just fine.
Billie Joe Sr. meets me and reporter Jonathan Jones outside his trailer on a warm spring day. His daughters, India, Tiffany, and Tiffany's husband, Cedric Johnson, are also there. Cedric tells us that Billie Joe stood out from other kids because of his character, and he thought he would have a big life, but he didn't live long enough to get there.
We know he wasn't a trouble person. He wasn't a young man to get in trouble. You know what I'm saying? He'd do the normal thing.
Was the family worried when he started dating a white girl?
And that I can't tell you, but I can tell you this, I was, point blank period, the day I seen it, I was totally against it. Now, growing up as a young black man in the South, no one have to tell me that I don't need to date a white girl. You don't have to tell me that. You know, I don't think you ever gonna feel that and know the results of that, what that means. But somehow it was just like, it's like if you born with a gene, a certain gene, you're born with it. That's just the way it was with me. It's like, but we know not to go there.
But as we know, Billie Joe did go there. He dated several white girls, but one stood out, Hannah Hollinghead.
I think honestly, deep down, he really did love her.
Drew Bradley grew up with Billie Joe and they played football together. He says Billy and Hannah couldn't stay away from each other. They started dating freshman year. They were both athletes, and in many ways, it was a typical on-again, off-again high school romance.
They always argued, and they'd break up, and everybody, all the people would be like, man, just leave her alone.
But Billie Joe was black, Hannah was white, and Drew, who's white, says racial divisions ran deep in Loosedale. He and Billy were able to bridge that gap, but they were two boys, no big deal. White girls dating black guys, well, that was a whole other story.
I mean, all the parents were like, oh my God, no, oh my God.
Generally, kids who were interracially dating kept it quiet in grade school.
Once we got to high school and they wouldn't let it be a secret no more and it was all out in the open, you know, the whole little town started whispering.
Another friend of Billie Joe's experienced that racism firsthand.
I dated a lot of white girls in high school, so, you know, some of the dads didn't want them talking to me or just punish them because they talking to a black guy and all kind of stuff.
R.J. Spivey says it wasn't always just talk.
Well, I had a run-in with one of my girlfriends. Her dad came over here in front of my house. He followed me and her over here. And we parked right there. And he tried to zoom up on the side of me while I couldn't get out. But I actually got out. My dad then was here though. But yeah, he followed us through town.
What'd he say when he pulled up?
As soon as I got out the car, I went to the house. My daddy came out. Him and my daddy had words. But it was all because she was with a black dude.
Mm-hmm. It's still a big deal in that little town.
Jada Havard was one of the white girls RJ dated in high school.
You can't be seen in public because, Lord forbid, if somebody sees you, you know, they're burning the phones up to call and be like, I saw this one with that one. And, you know, oh, my God, she's with a black man. Oh, it's just, it's terrible. And it's still that way.
We spoke to Jada's mom, Amy, about this, too. She says she didn't like it when Jada started dating black guys in high school.
I wasn't brought up like that, and I did not like it. I disapproved of it because my daughter done it, and I disapproved of it. I'll be the first to say I disapproved of it.
But she says she learned to accept it. Jada's mom said that Billy Joe and Hannah would often hang in her house after school. They'd also spend a lot of time at Hannah's aunt's house, who lived in the same complex. She says Hannah would sneak around to see Billy Joe. And for the 10th grade prom, Hannah told her parents, Esther and Ed, that she was going with Jada when she was actually going with Billy Joe.
Her parents didn't even know she was going to the prom with him because when my daughter told me they were going together, I was like, oh, my God, Ed is going to kill her. But they ended up meeting. She ended up going to the prom with him. They never approved of them two, ever. I don't know if it was really a racist thing because I'm not going to say maybe it was full-blown racist, but I think it was just they fought so much and there was always so much disagreement. I don't know if maybe, you know, they was just afraid it was going to be, you know, a major bad deal if they broke up. You know, and you never know what your kids say to their parents or whatever, but I'm not going to just, you know, throw it all off on racism.
She said Hannah's parents didn't like Billy Joe because he would roughhouse with Hannah. And she heard he had thrown Hannah up against her locker at school. Now, she never witnessed any of this firsthand. And Jada and at least three other people we spoke to have a different opinion as to why Hannah's folks didn't like Billy Joe.
It was all color related. That was it. That was bottom line, it was color.
Hannah's mom wouldn't do a recorded interview with us, and her dad never got back to us. So we weren't able to ask them about this ourselves. After going through the case files, we could only find a couple times that investigators brought up the issue of interracial relationships. Scott McElrath of the DA's office touches on it during an interview with Hannah's aunt, Tammy Hollinghead. She's the one that let Billy Joe and Hannah hang out at her place.
I have known about it since probably the beginning, which, like I said, two and a half years. I mean, overall, it was a good relationship, but like every teenager, they argued and they fussed. But as far as anything really bad, I can't say they was.
Even in the questions, you can sense how people in Loosedale might react to interracial relationships.
All right. Now, and I ask this question, I don't mean to embarrass you or anything, but you have pointed out to us that you yourself have some interracial children. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
And Ed, Hannah's dad, is your brother, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are there other interracial relationships in your family?
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of us. We have several cousins that's got mixed kids.
When Billy Joe died, one of the first things many people thought was that it had something to do with him dating white girls. The NAACP, many of Billy Joe's family, friends, and other community members all brought this up to us. So did medical examiner Dr. Adele Lewis. But in our review of the case file, race almost never comes up. None of the investigators from the NBI or the DA's office ask Hannah or her mother about it in either of their interviews. After months of trying to reach Hannah and Esther, one day, JJ's phone rings.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you so much for calling me back, and I do apologize. This is not the funnest part of my job, is to keep calling people. But I wanted to...
That's next on Reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose. so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you so much for calling me back. And I do apologize. This is not the funnest part of my job, is to keep calling people. But I wanted to...
After 2 years of trying to connect with Billy Joe's ex-girlfriend, Hannah Hollinghead, my reporting partner, Jonathan Jones, finally gets her on the phone.
I really would like to talk to you and tell you about what we're doing and just lay out everything for you.
She didn't agree to a recorded interview, but she did speak to JJ for about an hour. She told him that she has a family of her own now, but no matter what she does, Billy Joe's death has followed her. She says some people have accused her family of being involved. I ended up speaking with her on November 3rd, also not recorded. We talked for a bit. She said now that this series has come out, there's even more attention on the case and pressure on her family. She said Billy Joe was her first love and that he had a heart of gold. She told me she's married to a black man, and she said her parents didn't have a problem with Billy Joe because he was black. It was because he was aggressive with her. She was just 17 years old when he died, and she never wanted the public to know about it. She didn't mention it to police in her first interview, but when she and her mom were called in for more questioning, she brings it up.
Well, when Billy got really mad, he would hit me. And I had several bruises from Billy, but I never wanted to tell my parents because I didn't want to take it any further. And I didn't want to get him in trouble because Billy had everything going for him.
In the second interview, she tells investigators there were a series of incidents between her and Billy Joe before his death. Special Agent Joel Wallace, the lead investigator, mentions Hannah showed him her bruised arm on the day Billy Joe died.
We had dated for 2 years, on and off. And when all this happened, we weren't dating at the time. He actually had another girlfriend, and I have found out about it. And it was the time that he acted different. He was mad. He said things he didn't mean when he was mad, made threats, but I know deep down in my heart he didn't mean them. And, I mean, he was a great guy. He would give the shirt off his back to anybody. But Billy had anger problems that everybody seemed to overlook.
Joel asked Hannah about her dad.
Okay. And has he had any altercations or any conversations or something or anything with Billy Joe?
Him and Billy talked.
I mean, have they been in any, I ain't talking about talking, I'm talking about have they been in any arguments or disagreements about you and him dating or anything that you know of?
I mean, of course, Daddy didn't like the fact, but he never fought with, him and Billy never had hard words.
He then turns to Hannah's mom.
Have you, Miss Esther Parker, have you had any?
We had words, and what I mean by that is, we just didn't agree.
Mm-hmm.
I did not like the way that he treated my daughter.
Right.
It was always due to the fact that something, either he had pulled on her jerked her around, something like that. It was never a good thing. It's always a bad situation. I've had to go to school and talk to the school because he had pushed on her, jerked on her, pulled her around.
Hannah's mom has brought in a handwritten affidavit from the beginning of the school year. It alleges that Billy Joe put Hannah in fear of serious bodily harm by making threats against her.
That stemmed to September when I had to go to the school. That was one of the times when he had jerked her out of the car at school in the parking lot. He'd pulled her by the hair and head and some other things.
We talked to R.J. Spivey, who told us he remembers Esther coming to school all upset around that time, but isn't sure why.
I was sitting in Miss Clinton class, and Coach Nelson come to the door and asked me to come out to class. When I went out there, asked him what was wrong, he said, could I come get Billy, calm Billy down? And I'm like, for what? What happened? He's like, Esther up here, and him and Esther getting into it, and Billy upset. He was like, just can you come walk him off, you know? So I said, yeah. Then I went down there where it was. They were down there by the front office. And I went down there and got Billy. I was like, hey, man, just stop fussing with him. And Esther kept walking with him. Billy was turning around to walk out. Esther was still saying stuff. Then I turned around and tell Coach Nelson, hey, man, y'all just tell her to leave the school.
And it was that following Wednesday, I went and made charges, harassment charges on him at Justice Court.
Investigators tried to verify this. They were told the case was sent to youth court, but there's no further information about it in the case file. And Billy Joe's dad says no one got in touch with him about it. RJ and other friends we spoke to say they never saw Billy Joe hit Hannah.
No, I ain't never saw none of it. And I feel like if he was putting a hand on you, you would know.
Allegations of abuse should always be taken seriously. We take them seriously. Investigators should have taken them seriously, too. But according to the case files, they didn't try to verify these claims, so we made every effort. Billy Joe Sr. said he'd never been told any of this, and the Johnsons don't believe Billy Joe hit her. His older sister, Tiffany, says,
he was a minor at the time. Why wasn't my parents notified? But they have all that, as they say. Junior was this and he was that. But you never try to get in contact with the parents to talk about it. Discuss nothing, let them know that their son was beating their daughter. I mean, none of this. It was none of that. No police records, no charges pressed, no nothing.
Hannah says Billy Joe's coaches protected him. His head coach, Al Jones, and one assistant coach told us they never heard of any abuse. We reached out to the school resource officer, a former teacher, high school counselors, and administrators. None of them agreed to an interview. The Johnsons even requested Billy Joe's records, but they say the school no longer had them. During the second interview with police, Esther brings up a run-in they had with Billy Joe at the county fair.
I said, Billy, look, we've asked you very nicely, just leave her alone. That's all I want you to do. We've been nice about it. Just leave her alone. That's all we want you to do. And he was like, I don't have to listen to you. I don't want to talk to you. You need to do something with her. I don't want to talk to her.
Esther also mentions a phone call she had with Billy Joe.
I was home for lunch. He called my phone. I let him talk, and then I finally told him. I said, Billy, remember, you called me, so now it's time for you to listen to me. You know that I'll never approve of the situation. You'll never be welcome in my home, but I will always love my daughter and try to protect her. And I said, I want you to know, if you hurt her, I'm going to see that something is done, and you need to know this.
I'm going to see that something is done. It just hangs in the room. But investigators never follow up on the statement. When we interviewed Joel Wallace, he said after speaking with us, he would have conducted the interview differently. He would have asked some follow-up questions. On the days leading up to his death, Hannah describes Billy Joe as unraveling.
Billy had good days and he had bad days. And Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday were bad days for him.
She says they had a big argument in the high school parking lot that Friday, her birthday, after he told her that he started seeing someone else, but that he still loved her. After that, she says, Billy Joe kept trying to get in touch with her, leaving cryptic messages.
And then Sunday, he had sent my phone messages but I would read them and delete them. And Sunday night, he had texted one of my other friends and said that things were going to be different on Monday, that everybody would know him and everybody would know me, and George County would know who we are.
Investigators never really follow up on these allegations. They don't ask her why she was deleting these text messages, and it doesn't appear they tried to check this out with Hannah's friends. There are no easy answers here, but one truth. We would know much more about these accusations, both against and from Hannah's family, if investigators had followed up on what they heard, including this allegation from Hannah and her mom during their second interview with investigators.
The only thing that I can, just by sitting here listening to her, that I see that she's leaving out is the fact that the Thursday afternoon prior to this happening, a statement was made in the barbershop where all these kids get their hair cut, is that it's going to end and I'm going to take Hannah with me.
So, and are you implying that Billy made a statement?
Billy made this statement in the barbershop Thursday afternoon prior to the 8th.
And who did he make that to?
I'm not sure. There was a bunch of them
in there, and we were told that, you know, that he made the statement, and they all just kind of brushed it off because they thought he was just talking.
And what barbershop would that be, the Special 8 in Wallace?
It's called Ease. It's located in Palm Plaza, next to the Pizza Hut here in Moosedale.
Would it have been other high school students that he made this comment to? Or
yeah, there were high school students.
Were they football players of his, yeah, friends of his?
Who were they? Let's name them.
R.J. Spivory, Chavis Jones, and I want to say Aaron Ward was in there.
When I heard this part of the interview, I was shocked. It seems like they're claiming Billy Joe threatened to kill himself and Hannah. Joe Wallace follows up.
And how would you know that? I mean, I'm just asking. Devil's advocate. How would you know? Somebody told you that he said that?
Yeah.
Who that would have been?
I think it was Chavis and RJ. I met them that morning of the 8th. I met them, and they said that, I mean, he was talking about it in the barbershop. And then Aaron Moore texted me a few days like after it, and he said, well, I mean, he told me that he didn't know what had happened and everything, but he said that Billy had been talking about it in the barbershop, but they all just kind of looked at him and told him he was crazy.
JJ and I went through all the case files to see if investigators talked to anyone to verify this claim that Billy Joe had talked about killing himself 4 days before his death. But there's nothing. So we followed up ourselves.
How many times do you think you cut Billy Joe's hair?
I've been cutting Billy Joe's hair ever since I think he was in the 7th, 8th grade.
And
he was big then.
Ernest McCann runs Ease Barbershop. It's in a strip mall next to an old Pizza Hut in Loosedale.
How often would he come in for a haircut?
He would come in, if not every week, every other week.
The shop is like where I grew up getting my haircut, a place where people gather not just for a cut, but to talk to the barber and each other. It's been over a decade since Billy's death, but according to Ernest, not much has changed at the shop. Same building, same barber. Our biggest question for Ernest was, did he remember Billy Joe saying something like, it was all going to end, and he was going to take Hannah with him?
I never heard it come out of his mouth. I never heard it. Just like I say, I never heard it. I never heard him talk about it, and I've been cutting his hair for a minute, and I ain't never heard him say anything in that way about killing somebody.
Ernest remembers the last time Billy Joe came in for a cut.
That was my last time cutting his hair before he got killed, so that's how I remember that Thursday. And ever since that day when he got killed, it always been, you know what I'm saying, when I think of Billy Joe, I think of the last day I cut his hair. So it wasn't like, what, 2-3 days after he got his hair cut?
He says Billy Joe was alone that day, which was unusual because he tended to come with a group of friends. Given what Esther and Hannah said, you'd think investigators would talk to Ernest.
Did anybody follow up with you on this?
Never. I never talked to anybody about anything. Yeah. Officers or lawyers or investigators or anything, none of those.
We also tracked down Billy Joe's friends, the ones Hannah said were there when he made that statement at the barbershop.
That's totally false. That's totally false. He never, ever said anything.
That's Aaron Ward. We caught him on a cell phone, so the sound isn't great. He says it's totally false. Billy Joe never, ever said anything like it.
And you're 100% sure you never heard Billy Joe say anything like that?
Yes, I'm 100% positive.
We played it for Chavis Jones.
He didn't know what had happened and everything, but he said that Billy had been talking about it in the barbershop, but they all just kind of looked at him and told him he was crazy.
And that never happened. Never happened.
Remember, Chavis is now a sheriff's deputy.
And that's what didn't make sense. Like, she told them in the meet that we supposedly was witness to him saying that he was going to kill himself and her. Why didn't they ever come talk to us? I never heard anything of that until I talked to you the first time.
Yep.
First time I ever heard of it. And it's been years ago. I never heard anything about it. Why didn't anybody say anything to us about it?
JJ and I asked RJ what he thought.
Have you ever even heard about this conversation before?
Why do you think she would make up a story that wouldn't be true?
I don't know. I think from listening to that, because I feel like Hannah didn't know what her mom was talking about. Because when she said, I think RJ and Chavis, I mean, how can you think? That wasn't too far ago. That was a month. Wasn't you say a month after it happened?
Yeah.
Well, how you forget something that quick? Something that important?
Both Chavis and RJ told us they weren't even at the barbershop Thursday with Billy, just like Ernest the barber said. None of them ever heard Billy make that threat, not that day or any other. I don't know what to make of Hannah and her mom's statements to the police, but it was the job of investigators and the district attorney to follow up on those leads, and they didn't. This is a big problem because the Justice Department cited statements from Hannah and her mother as part of the reason they thought suicide was likely. Their interviews carry a lot of weight because investigators didn't do more work to check them out. So next, we asked the people who knew Billy Joe best what his mindset was in the days before his death.
Ain't no way for him to kill himself. He wasn't suicidal. I don't know what they talking about.
At all.
You're listening to Reveal. Before we move on, I should say that this segment deals with sensitive issues surrounding suicide and the emotional trauma around it. It may not be suitable for everybody. JJ and I returned to Billy Joe's home this summer. It's a hot morning. Chickens are running through the yard. The trailer door opens and out comes Billy Joe Sr. We make small talk with him as we wait for his children, yeah. Tiffany, India, and Eddie to arrive.
You been doing all right?
Yeah, just going through a lot of different things.
Yeah?
Well, back, and then I messed my knee up, so.
How'd you mess your knee up?
It's from my back. It just gave out on me. It gave out on me, and I fell and messed that inside of it up right here. I go therapy 2 days out of a week. And that ain't hitting my back none, trying to do that exercise. That make it that much more worse.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You want to sit down or are you okay, Sam?
Oh, I'm good.
All right. Yeah.
When Tiffany gets there, we start talking about the Justice Department's report on Billy Joe's death. Remember, the Johnsons petitioned the DOJ to look into the case. On April 15th, 2011, a year and a half after his death, the DOJ sent a letter to the Johnson family. Tiffany reads this to us.
Dear Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, please accept our condolences on the tragic death of your son, Billy Joe Jr.
The family had a lot of hope that the feds would open a new investigation and give them the justice they believe local authorities hadn't.
We have determined that there is insufficient evidence to prove beyond reasonable doubt that the allegation that Deputy Sullivan or any other officer...
The grand jury had ruled that Billy Joe's death was an accidental shooting and that the wound path did not support homicide or suicide. The DOJ's forensic experts disagreed with that and said the most likely cause of death was suicide.
Accordingly, we are closing this matter without pursuing a federal prosecution.
Case closed. At this point, JJ and I have been visiting the Johnsons for 2 years. In all that time, we never really asked them about the possibility that Billy Joe killed himself.
Let me ask you guys this. It's a hard question. Neither JJ or I want to ask it, but like this is what's going to come up when people like hear the story.
It's a hard thing to talk about, but I have to ask.
I got to ask you this. Is it possible that Billy Joe went to Hannah's house, some craziness went down, he's running, scared, he thinks that like he's messed up majorly, everything is falling apart, and he grabs that shotgun and kills himself?
No, ain't no way.
What do you think about
my
that,
daddy too? Talking. Don't let my daddy talk.
No, I really don't have too much to say about it, because ain't no way for him to kill himself. He wasn't suicidal. I don't know what they talking about.
At all.
I mean, but why would you be suicidal when you got everything going for you?
Life ahead of you, and you were so excited about this football. Why would you do that?
I would say that, like, some people would say that they think that Billy had a hard relationship with his family because he stayed a lot with his coach.
Now, he never had a hard relationship with his family.
So you guys just feel strongly like there's no way that Billy Joe...
No, there ain't no way.
No way.
I'm around my brother every day. We talked about everything. He
come to the house all the time. I don't know what they keep getting this accusation from, talking about that he had a problem with his family. He never had no problem with his family. I don't understand that.
That fall, Billy Joe had stayed with a friend whose dad was an assistant coach on the football team. Gas prices were high, and it saved him money on his commute into school from Bendale.
Suicide, no. A happy person walking around every day for what?
That's what I was saying, because somebody asked me that, and I was more or less like, are you kidding me? I'm talking like, this is somebody that I have raised.
I just know
my parents work. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I slept in bed with my brother and my kid. We talked about stuff. I talked to my brother Sunday, the day before. We talked forever. Talked about everything. He didn't sound like he was depressed, nothing to me. Nothing. And then all of a sudden, Monday, this is what you get. He was depressed about what? What was he depressed about?
This is the same thing we heard from almost everyone we talked to. Billy Joe's friends, coaches, and members of the community. None of them felt like he would take his own life. And when I talked to his ex-girlfriend, Hannah Hollinghead, she told me no one would ever be able to convince her that Billy Joe took his life intentionally. Of the dozens of people we spoke to, no one said they saw any sign that he was thinking about taking his own life or saw any sudden changes in behavior. Folks told us there was something special about Billy Joe. He didn't drink or use drugs. He liked to drive a little too fast and played video games. They described him as a fun-loving kid, someone who always made you laugh or would send a loving text message. His head coach, Al Jones, said Billy Joe formed special bonds with the people around him.
Billy Joe, the kids loved him, but he can also get very down on himself sometimes. And he, you know, he just highs and lows sometimes, you know, because if he didn't score a touchdown, he'd get frustrated. And that's just, you know, you're not going to score a touchdown. That's just part of it. And just the mentality, but the kids loved him. That was tremendous impact. When you lose a player in high school, because high school kids don't think about death. They're invincible. That's just their nature.
The night before he died, he spoke to a friend, Ashley O'Neill, on the phone. This was his last cell phone call, according to records. Ashley told me that they were making plans to go Christmas shopping when he got back from the awards banquet. She says he seemed concerned about something, but he didn't mention what it was.
I guess, like, the question I have is, if he called you and was, like, sounding a little stressed out, some people would say, like, well, maybe he was considering killing himself then.
Oh, no, we was going shopping. Like, I'm full. We was going to go shopping. He would not have killed himself. He was not that type of person.
Dr. David Jobes is a professor of psychology at Catholic University and one of the foremost experts on suicide. He told us that if suicide had been a possibility, investigators should have interviewed a lot more people.
If you really wanted to get it right, you'd be interviewing a dozen people, you know, who knew the decedent well and the days leading up to his death, piecing together a mosaic and not just relying on one source where there might be an agenda or guilt and or regret. And so that part of it is curious to me.
He wrote his doctoral dissertation on determining suicide in sudden death investigations. We asked him to review the DOJ report. He said there were flaws in the investigation because a psychological autopsy was never performed.
It would be like a physical autopsy where you're examining the body to look at the mechanisms and the causes of death. So it's meant to be parallel, but the parallel is not a body. It's a set of interviews, looking potentially at medical records, looking at therapy notes, if they exist, mostly interviews of people that knew the person. And you'd want to have a number of those interviews from different perspectives that you then pull together to formulate a sense about a psychological intent. And so I would not say, from what I saw, that a proper psychological autopsy was conducted in this case, which is a shame because there's enough equivocality to it that I would think some of that information would have been valuable to get.
What type of things would you be expecting to see? Like, what type of things in your death investigation checklist express suicidal thoughts, verbal statements, like that kind of thing?
It would be the kind of stuff where they're dropping hints left and right. More than one person could have said, yeah, he was talking about checking out, or that maybe it's not worth it, or he was overwhelmed by all the scholarship offers, that type of thing. And so that you'd have more people basically saying, yeah, you know, he didn't seem quite right. There was a rapid descent. He would get in these very moody states and get pretty dark. So there'd be a lot of like corroborating testimony or evidence of people that knew the deceased saying, yeah, you know, it strikes me that this is something that was on his mind.
Jobes says the DOJ jumped to conclusions because the investigators didn't do this work. For example, they said Billy Joe had previously threatened suicide. But as far as we can tell, that was based entirely on statements that Hannah and her mom made to local investigators. We asked his friends and family whether he had threatened suicide. They all said no. We couldn't find any sign that the district attorney's office, state investigator Joel Wallace, or the DOJ tried to verify Hannah's statement. And remember, when I spoke to Hannah recently, she was adamant. There is no way he would ever kill himself. In the DOJ's report, forensic psychologist Dr. Rosemary Malone suggested another theory of why Billy Joe would kill himself. She wrote that Billy Joe must have been under acute stress in the moment, thinking he was being pulled over for breaking into Hannah's house, and he killed himself as a spontaneous reaction. I asked Dr. Jobes what he made of that.
There's a lot of contention around that, Al. The idea of sudden suicides or impulsive suicides is out there. Most of us kind of think that it's hard for me to imagine, for example, that I would get off this interview and then walk out and step in front of a car. It just doesn't, in my experience, really happen that way. There's usually some background or some evidence that this person's had it on their mind to varying degrees. But as we start out the whole conversation, there's a lot of people that would just rather look the other way.
Yeah.
It's an uncomfortable topic. And people just don't like talking about this.
No. It's just vastly
horrible. It's horrific. And there's just no way that someone who loses someone this way ever is satisfied with why.
Yeah.
That's one of the most wretched aspects of losing someone this way.
And that's why, he says, investigators should have broadened the scope of the people they interviewed to get those answers for the family. To strengthen their conclusion that it was suicide, the DOJ said Billy Joe's age, gender, and race were risk factors, since the rate of suicide increases among African-American males during adolescence. I hadn't heard that before, that young Black men are at a higher risk of suicide, so I reached out to Dr. Wisdom Powell. She's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut, and she researches African-American mental health.
So I want to just back into this a little bit differently and respond a little bit to that assumption that his age, gender, and race make him more of a risk for suicide than other groups.
She says a recent study did find that African-American boys had a higher rate of suicide, but that doesn't mean an individual is more likely to kill himself. She said you need to understand what was going on in their life at the time, what stresses they were facing. So I told her about the evidence that the DOJ cited that led them to say Billy Joe killed himself.
They have two people who say that Billy Joe was suicidal and not talking to his friends and not talking to his family and not getting any other proof to back that up.
It's very difficult to know if a person is truly going to complete a suicide. So when folks talk about warning signs, there are some, obviously, warning signs that we can look for. And we know what those are. People talking about wanting to die, expressing a lot of guilt and shame, feeling empty, hopeless, changing their behavior, making a plan or researching ways to die, taking dangerous risks, right? You know, before the actual suicide. So those are the kinds of warning signs that one would be asking close members of the family and friends about. They wouldn't necessarily show up often in non-intimate relationships or like in non-familial relationships. It would be hard for me to understand why you wouldn't talk to the family about those things because of what we know about the intimacy of suicidal ideation and risk behavior. So it's just striking to me.
Everyone we spoke to, including Hannah, told us that Billy Joe was not suicidal. If investigators had asked those questions and gotten the same information when Billy Joe died, maybe the Justice Department would have looked at other possibilities. Suicide is so hard to talk about. There's a shame that can follow friends and family like a shadow. I know, because I lost someone to it. And nothing made sense for a while afterwards. It's like a black hole that consumes all the light. And no matter how hard you try to understand, you're just stumbling in the dark. When my loved one killed himself, I went through several stages: disbelief, heartbreak, anger, until I found the penumbra between what is known and what is unknowable. I will never know why he did it. But what I do know is that he loved me. And he didn't do it to hurt me or anyone else. But the loss his family and friends feel is incalculable. So I'm asking you, please, if you're feeling overwhelmed or thinking about taking your own life, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. Again, that's 1-800-273-8255. It can get better. It may not be easy getting there, but it's worth it. You are worth it. Next week, we're going to take a break from the Billy Joe Johnson story. But when we come back...
It was multiple times. It was something we talked about. He would give such a hard time.
Friends and family believe Billy Joe was being targeted by the police.
I mean, just a kid just going about doing his thing and not really, you know, doing nothing wrong. And you'd be riding around with him and he would get pulled over for nonsense just to be given a hard time.
By one officer in particular, who was not the deputy who pulled him over.
And like I said, there ain't nothing ever going to be on file that he never wrote no tickets. He just pulled us over and gave us a hard time and harassed us.
That's in 2 weeks. Our show was reported by Jonathan Jones and me, edited by our executive producer, Kevin Sullivan. Michael I. Schiller is a series producer. Stephen Rascone is our production assistant. Nina Martin edited our digital material. Andy Donahue is Reveal's executive editor of projects. We had additional reporting and producing help from Co Bragg, Melissa Lewis, Michael Montgomery, and Laurel Hennin Vigil. Special thanks to Catherine Miskowski, Jen Cheehan, Alexis Hightower, and to actor Steve Isom Phillips for reading the court transcript. Mama Blues sang our theme song, which was written and composed by Nina Simone, thanks to her estate and music and strategy. Our fact checker is Rosemarie Ho. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy the Great Mustafa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help from Claire C. Note Mullen, Najib Amini, Brett Simpson, Catherine Steyer Martinez, and Amita Ganatra. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our interim CEO is Annie Schabel. Sumi Agarwal is our interim editor-in-chief. Be sure to tune in next week for our investigation into Amazon. The Superstore has a wealth of information on you. Everything from your brand of toothpaste to the movies you stream online. And it turns out, all that information isn't as secure as it should be. That's next week on Reveal. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, there is always more to the story.
From PRX.